And I'm a longtime grassroots environmental activist. My first degree was in physics, but I didn't really like science very much. And then I became a commercial beekeeper. And when I was in my late 20s, I went back to get a master's in fine arts. And then I've been writing and doing activism ever since.
Okay. Yeah, I usually do just a little bit of background myself, too, just so you know who I am and stuff. I'm a psychologist, and I've been practicing for about 6 years. And in that time, learning lots of things about how people are, how they get unwell, and what types of things influence that. And I think it has a lot to do with the type of world that we live in. I think you might use the word civilization, living in civilization itself. And I stumbled across some of your work as I was doing some surfing of YouTube videos and whatnot. And, your work really resonated with me, and listening to some of your lectures and, some of the talks that you've given at some of the, I'm guessing, environmental summits and stuff like that. And so I just wanted to see if we could share some thoughts on subjects that are probably that we share similar interests in regards to how things happen to people and to the world and stuff like that. And I sent you that email with a few of my, I guess, number one inquiries, and you were open to talking about the subject of hypocrisy. And how that can be something that is used as an argument from people who really buy into the dominant cultural paradigm and see anyone who is speaking against or talking about environmental issues and speaking about how cultural issues can make people sick. As soon as you start kind of talking like that, or I don't know, going against the dominant ways, then it's almost like a bag of tricks that can be pulled out against you and kind of used to, I think, bring you into submission, subdue, that kind of thing. And I did only make it through about, I think, just over half of your book, Endgame, which I think is a fabulous book. And every page, I think, is... I resonate with every page. I got up to bringing down civilization part one. That's where I got up to today. But yes, that's who I am and where I'm at. And I work with people every day, helping them with common mental health issues. And I run a blog about borderline personality disorder, which I'm highly invested in because it was part of my life experience. And I think it's something that happens to people living in the dominant culture quite commonly. Just one of, I guess, the many ailments that we can find ourselves struggling with. So, yeah, I guess that would be introductions there. And what's your cat's name, by the way?
Gray Kitty.
Gray Kitty?
Yeah.
That's awesome. So, speak to the subject of hypocrisy as it relates to, I guess, people who are trying to fight or speak up for environmental causes, for things that are, you know, that we feel threatened by, or some of us do. How would you speak to that, I guess, using some of the things that you've already articulated really well in your book and help people like me and others who are faced with that kind of counter defense?
Well, it's something that has been thrown out a lot of times, oftentimes rather absurdly. I was doing a talk one time just a couple decades ago, and I talked about how civilization is killing the planet, and how we need how the planet's more important than than any social system, and how the health of the planet needs to be primary. And this guy came up to me after the talk and said, "Do you have a bank account?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm not sure why it's any of your business." He said, "Well, in that case, I can discount everything you said." And you see this all the time that, well, do you use toilet paper? Then you can't complain about deforestation. Do you? And there are a few things wrong with it. First off, it is a logical fallacy. It's ad hominem, because whether I live pretty simply, which I do, but that's primarily because I'm a cheapskate and not because of – it doesn't matter politically. And anyways, it's ad hominem, because whether I do or don't live simply is irrelevant to the actual message. There's a in the American Civil War, there was a Confederate general named Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was a horrible racist. He, prior to the war, was a he ran a slave market. During the war, he was probably responsible for the Fort Pillow massacre. And after the war, he helped start the KKK. So he's a very, very, very bad guy. Nonetheless, and this, my nonetheless does not excuse any of the horrible things he did, he was a brilliant general. And somebody asked him once, "So how do you win battles?" And he said, "The answer is you get there first with the most." And this is still taught in military academies today. The point being that, yes, he's a racist. Yes, he's all these other horrible things. And that doesn't alter the fact that that statement that he made is true. And so my point in choosing such an extreme example is that one can – is it ad hominem is absurd. So that's the first. The second thing that's probably a lot more important is that a lot of sort of the simple living activists have trumpeted for years, and you still see this all the time, that the solutions to the murder of the planet are for each of us individually to consume less. And that's we need to understand some history about that, which is in the 1980s was the first time that the corporate newspapers called human beings consumers more often than it called them citizens. And that's really important, because if you can convince people that they're consumers and that's their primary means of social interaction and their primary means of political action, then their choices of resistance are reduced to consume and don't consume. Whereas if you're a citizen, your choices are consume, don't consume, boycott, organize, leaflet, vote, don't vote. And when a government becomes destructive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, then you have the right to alter or abolish the government. You can revolt. And so the point is, if you can be convinced by neoliberalism and by the corporate presses that you are a consumer, then those are your choices. And some simple living as a political act is really reduced to that. It's defining yourself as your political power comes through consumption only. And that's another problem. And yet another problem is that it's pretty ineffective. That let's say that you reduced your waste. I just saw a video about this a couple of days ago about some people who had reduced their waste. Oh, actually, I saw a video about some people in the UK who were living carbon neutral lives individually. And it's just crazy, because that the amount of carbon that you are personally responsible for is really trivial. And it's the same with waste. If I was able to – I actually don't produce much waste. And if I were able to reduce it to zero, it wouldn't really matter because about 98% of the waste produced by this culture is produced by agriculture and industry. Humans, individual humans, are only doing about 2%. So you're working on a very small percentage. And it's likewise with water. The world's running out of water, they say, and that's why we should take shorter showers. Well, actual human consumption of showers is about 3% of total consumption. It's mainly 90% is agriculture and industry. There's more water used for municipal golf courses than is used for all municipal human beings. So if you want to cut down on water usage, well, first, get rid of golf courses. And my point, again, is not to have a problem with somebody living simply, but to recognize that that's not a particularly political act, and that instead a political act would be some act of resistance that that changes the material conditions of society. And then one last thing, which is, it's like a friend of mine says that the task of an activist is not to navigate systems of oppressive authority with as much personal integrity as possible. The task of an activist is to confront and take down those systems of oppressive authority. So, and a way to think about this is, if we were in Nazi Germany, what would we consider real acts of resistance? They would be the acts of resistance that were undertaken by the members of the resistance, which includes propaganda, you know, the White Rose Society with their leaflets. It includes attempting to kill Hitler. It includes sabotage. All of that. Nobody in their right mind would think, I'm resisting Hitler by biking to work. I'm resisting Hitler by composting. And it's the same. If aliens came down from outer space and they were vacuuming the oceans, deforesting the planet, putting docks in every mother's breast milk, we wouldn't think that somebody who was composting, that this was a brilliant act of resistance. I got nothing against composting. Composting's fine. It's just not resistance.
Yeah.
One more thing, which is also, I've heard this complaint thrown out by people who should know better. And okay, first off, I just got to say, before the personal, you know, the purity police come after me, that I haven't flown for pleasure in 30 years. I just, mainly because I don't really like traveling, and I've flew to a lot of talks, et cetera, et cetera. And I just heard somebody complaining the other day that doing this exact same thing, saying Bill McKibben's a hypocrite because he flies to do talks. And there are some places where I disagree with Bill McKibben, but that's just absurd. I mean, are we supposed to take on the entire military-industrial complex, the entire corporate state, and what? We're supposed to walk naked everywhere, and we're not supposed to use the social media, and we're not supposed to use paper? And it's like, I don't know. I'm actually talking about a serious resistance movement where you use every tool available, which includes travel when necessary. It includes using the law when necessary. It includes breaking the law when necessary. It means being effective. It doesn't mean those humans who live 100 years from now, they are not going to care whether you or I recycled. They're not going to care whether we took shorter showers. They're not going to care whether we had a good time. They're not going to care whether we were nice to each other particularly. What they're going to care about is whether they can breathe the air and drink the water. What they're going to care about is whether the land can support them. And insofar as me – I mean, every day when I walk through the forest here, I throw out food for the forest. And that's a nice little contribution. But I have to fully recognize that by itself – I mean, that's making some chipmunks happy, making some bears happy, making some birds happy. And that's really important. But – it's not stopping the deforestation. We have to recognize those are separate things.
Thank you. And I like how you articulated in, like, on so many levels. And I think that quite often in the culture nowadays, like you mentioned, like the social media, we can get caught in the meme culture and the dramatically oversimplified ways of looking at things. And, you know, a person can see a meme saying, you know, if you're using fossil fuels and you're complaining about the environment, then immediately you're a hypocrite and you're not to be listened to. But I like how you bring it at these other angles and more realistically, I would say as well, because you know you're noticing that. You know, for one thing, we're trapped in a certain type of set of things.
Oh, can I respond to that?
I just listened to a talk from David Suzuki. He was meeting with this, I think, a corporate CEO, and it was about time to talk about extinction. Was I think the YouTube title, something like that, and then he ended up boiling it down to the rules of the game need to change, and not really individuals, like, because individuals changing will basically do nothing, but the rules of the game, which people, they're not willing to really talk about. Another guy, Richard Wolf, I think his name, he's an economist teacher, professor, and he basically said the same things, and how capitalism ends up being extremely self-defeating, cutting itself off from the poor, and that because ultimately people just get more and more greedy and the rules of the game never change. Do you see it that way? That same way about the rules of the game, so to speak?
Well, in many ways. First, yeah, personal change does not equal social change. They're not the same things at all. And something we have to understand is that there are functional problems in society that are based on resource movement. And if it doesn't matter how enlightened or how nice you are, as long as those larger structures stay in place. When you have a way of life that requires mining, oh, here's an example. So a few years ago, I got interviewed by this guy who was a dedicated Marxist. He said that it is possible to design an industrial society where everyone does their job voluntarily, where all exchanges are voluntary, no coercion on anybody. I said, great. So you got cities? He said, yeah. I said, how do you get around in the city? He said, public transport. I said, great. What are your buses made of? He said, metal. I said, great. Where do you get the metal? He said, from a mine. I said, okay, how do you get people to work in the mine? Because mining is one of the most miserable existences on the planet, and it was one of the first sources of slavery, and to this day, there are people enslaved in mines. He said, we just pay them a lot. I said, well, we'll leave that aside, but just what do you do? We recognize that all hard rock mining destroys rivers, right? Every river. So, I mean, there are still mines that are polluting from the Roman days. So every hard rock mine pollutes rivers, right? He said, yes. I said, okay, so what do you do about the people who live next to the river? And they fish from the river, and that's their livelihood. And that's their way of life. He says, well, you pay them to move. I said, what if they don't want money? He said, well, you pay them more. And I said, well, what if their ancestors are buried on this land and so they can't leave because it will destroy their entire cultural identity and it will destroy their culture? So they refuse however much money you give them. He said, well, how many of them are there? I said, I don't know, 400? He said, well, the million people in the city vote, and they vote that those people by the river have to leave, and then you go out and remove them. I said, I see. So you've gone from purely voluntary exchanges to democratic empire, land theft from indigenous people, and genocide, all within less than 2 minutes, just so you can have a bus. And my point is, this is just really sort of Lewis Mumford's territory, where if you have certain technologies that require certain social forms, if you have a mine, that means you have to have a military to go and steal the land from the people who live there. It means you have to have a police system to force people into the mines. You have to have a police system to keep people from stealing the refined ores, I mean the refined metals, you have to have a transportation system to move it from the mine to the metropolis and so on. So all of those, as soon as you have a city which requires the importation of resources, then you have to have a way of life that's based on a military to go conquer and steal those resources and a police to control them. And so my point is that me being very proud of the fact that I only go to the dump with a pickup load of trash every 6 months, which is true, that doesn't mean diddly squat in terms of actual changing the culture. There's still, as long as we have this way of life that has these consumer goods and these material goods, not just consumers, it's also the infrastructure, then you have to have certain social forms. Anyway, long story short of it's just that we need to the small personal choices. I mean, for crying out loud, yeah, I had a vasectomy and I didn't have any children, but that hasn't particularly helped overpopulation that much. Even when I was touring a lot, I did the math. Even when I was touring a lot, so I was flying a fair amount, I figured out I was responsible for something. I don't remember the math right now, but I was responsible for something like one out of every $900 million of United's revenue. So it's just a very, very short lever. And mm-hmm. one of the reasons that we go to this lever so much, I mean, it's not that in the 1980s the corporate newspapers started to push an agenda for nefarious political reasons. Instead, it's that I think it's a measure of our hopelessness and a measure of our despair, because I think it's a lot of people saying, I can't affect change in the real world. I believe I can't affect change in the real world. And if I can't affect change in the real world, the least I can do is at least take my itty bitty shorter shower, as opposed to, and also it's because we don't want to face what the changes would really mean. Because if we really want to stop, I mean, people say all the time that they want to protect salmon, but they say, how can we save salmon? But what they really mean is not how can we save salmon. What they really mean is how can we save salmon without stopping industrial logging, without stopping industrial fishing, without removing the dams, without stopping the murder of the oceans, without stopping global warming. And you can't. And when people say, how can we stop global warming? They're not asking how we can stop global warming. What they're asking is how can we stop global warming without stopping agriculture, without stopping civilization, without stopping industrialism? And you can't. Which is why the answers that are presented to us are A, so obviously wrong, and B, don't even take the world as primary. It's all. And the way all this ties back to your field is that one of the ways I've been able to make sense of discourse in this culture is R.D. Lang has the three rules of a dysfunctional family. And rule A is don't, which means don't talk about the violence that you all have to pretend isn't going on. So rule A is don't. Rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A1 or A2. So you can't talk about the violence that you have to pretend isn't happening, and you can't talk about the fact that you can't talk about the violence that you have to pretend isn't happening. You can't talk about the fact that you can't talk about the fact that you can't talk about the fact that you can't talk about the violence you have to pretend isn't happening. And it's the same with the culture. So we all talk in the United States like we live in a democracy, and we all talk like changing light bulbs is going to make a difference. And we all talk like installing wind and solar is going to make a difference to global warming, when And those are all excuses to allow us not to look at the depth of what must be changed.
Yeah, so basically we can use our intellects to try and come up with new technologies is the thing, right? We can try and solve problems that way, but we can never look at the root. We can never really fully challenge the root of things or go too deep into things. I guess without being gaslit or ghosted. So I mean, ghosted being ignored, discredited, dismissed, or gaslit with those types of arguments like, how dare you challenge the system as it is when you yourself, blah, blah, blah. So those types
Here's another thing about that is that I live, okay, right just back there, 30 yards is a stream, salmon bearing stream. And it doesn't have very many salmon anymore because salmon are in big trouble. And 300 years ago, 100 years ago, I could have walked 30 yards that way, reached down, scooped up a fish, and I got dinner for two families for 2 days. And the fish aren't there any longer. So how dare you, not you, but how dare one, take the fish out of the river and then complain when I have to go to Safeway to get some food? And this is all intentional. On a personal level, this is something that abusers do all the time, is they don't. I read about an account. This was so cool. I read about an account of it was a rehab. It was a group counseling group for men who were required to go in because they had beaten their wives. And at one point, one of the therapists got the idea to say, so what's the ideal time? How long are you in a relationship before you find it appropriate to beat your wife? And they all just talked about it very frankly. It's like, you can't do it too early because you got to hook her first. You got to get her, you know, you got to get her dependent on you emotionally, financially, physically. Then, I mean, you don't do it first date. And that was true with my mom. My father, the first time he beat her was when she was pregnant with their first child. It's like, I got you now. You can't just walk away. And it's notorious that one of the reasons that abused victims stay with abusers is because they have been made dependent upon them in various ways, destruction of social system, etc. Now, on a larger scale, we know that the laws of apartheid were written because the mines needed labor. And the locals were in a subsistence economy, which means that they lived sustainably through subsistence farming, through hunting, gathering. They didn't have any cash. So the question is, how do we force these self-sufficient people into the mines? And the answer is you create hut taxes, poll taxes, dog taxes. You start taxing things because then somebody had to get some cash. They didn't have cash. How are you going to get cash? You go work in the mine. And so it was a very conscious attempt to do this. Likewise, in the 1830s, there was a letter from a pro-slavery philosopher in the South to his northern abolitionist buddy. Both of them are capitalists. And the slave-owning philosopher said, look, we would give up our slaves in a heartbeat if it were economically the right choice. And it's very simple. There are some land ownership conditions in which it's in the best interest for the capitalist to own slaves and to not own slaves. And it's very simple. If there's a lot of land and not many people, then that means that people have access to land, which means they have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they have access to self-sufficiency, which means the only way you can get them to go to work for you is if you put them in chains. On the other hand, if you got a lot of people and not much land, like in a city, or if you can convince the people that the big timber companies own all the land, well, in that case, they don't have access to land, which means they don't have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means that they don't have access to self-sufficiency, which means that they have to go to work for you. And my point is that, again, this is one of the things that frustrates me about so many of the people who complain because you go to the store, because the system has been set up to intentionally insert itself between us and the source of life. And I was just having an exchange with a guy a couple days ago who's a very profound environmentalist. His loyalty is completely with the natural world. And I don't remember what it was. I think he was asking for New Year's resolutions or something. And mine was, yeah, let's bring down civilization this year. And he wrote back, yeah, I'm completely with you. But it's really hard because all of us are dependent for civilization on our lives, dependent upon this way of life that's killing the planet. And I said, yeah, and that's been done intentionally. Just with all the logic I was just giving about any abusive system, nobody would put up with this crap if they hadn't been made addicts to the system. We have been enslaved to the system by it inserting itself between us and the source of all life. And a great way to think about this is where does your food come from? It comes from the grocery store. Where does your water come from? It comes from the tap. That's very important because the system has inserted itself there, and you will fight. The normal person, standard people, will fight to death to defend the system that brings that to them. It doesn't matter if it's fascist. It doesn't matter if it's authoritarian in any form. It doesn't matter if it is nice to you and bad to brown people. It doesn't matter if it's nice to you and bad to the world, because your life depends on it. And so you will, even when it's killing the planet, you will defend that to the death. As opposed to, for example, if your water comes from a river and your food comes from a land base, then you will defend those to the death. And so this is all really crucial, because one of the things we need to do is to break our loyalty to the very thing that is keeping us, that is at this point keeping us alive. And that's one of the brilliant things that this culture has done, has been to force that dependency. And then once it gets beyond a dependency for your actual food, clothing, and shelter, then it can become an addiction where, you know, man, I got to have my computer. I got to have, and Lewis Mumford calls that the magnificent bribe. But that's why we have given in so completely in the Western world, is because, for God's sake, we got to have whatever these microphones are called, and snowflake microphone, I think, or something. Anyway, we get to have fancy microphones. We get to have computers. We get to have hot showers. And none of those are sustainable. And there's a great line by Upton Sinclair: it's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it. And I would switch that a little bit to, it's hard to make people understand something when their entitlement depends on them not understanding it.
So is it fair to say, people would rather, I think from what you're saying, people would rather, I guess maybe they don't consciously know it, but they would rather stay in an abusive relationship with society, and I guess with each other in many cases, instead of like giving up phones and giving up all of our luxuries and conveniences, that is worth living in an abusive, unsustainable, insane way of life, or maybe it gets justified somehow.
Well, there are 100,000 people probably at the LSU University of Central Florida game today, and certainly there are 100,000 people in, oh God, there's probably a 500,000 people if you divide them between the, I think, five bowl games today. So there are more people who care about the LSU Tigers than who care about real Tigers. And part of it, I mean, this whole culture is killing the planet, and we need to stop it. The life is more important than this culture, but I mean, I understand the logic. You know, if you're going to be in essentially a prison system, I would much rather be one of the prisoners who's treated well than who's treated not. If we're going to live within capitalism, just individually, we would all – and that's the logic of capitalism, and that's the power of it, is that if I'm going to go buy a computer, am I going to buy one for $299 that is – made with a hard drive that poisoned women in Thailand when they put it together, or am I going to buy one for $6.99 that's made in America with Union? You know, it's like, that's $400 difference. And that's the problem with capitalism, is individuals can make those better choices, never mind the fact that the computer still has plastic and all sorts of other crap that should not have been wrenched from the earth. But that's the logic of capitalism, is that it makes it so you can it does a very good job. Some people are going to disagree with this, but I don't care. It does a very good job of delivering goods to consumers, delivering goods to rich consumers. And its point is not to allow a livable planet. Its point is not to create social justice. Its point is to deliver money to rich people by delivering consumer goods to semi-rich people. What I'm talking around here the whole time is that the problems we face are systemic and the entire system needs to change. And there are systems of social rewards set up that, I mean, it doesn't matter whether you call yourself Bolsheviks or capitalists or whatever you call yourself. If you're going to industrialize, it's that process I was talking about earlier. It's going to require destruction of land bases and destruction of people who live on those land bases.
Yeah, it's like you can't have something for nothing. You have to, I guess, take in order to have convenience and luxury. You have to, it's part of the deal.
Yeah. Sense. Yeah, and we think that, it's so funny that sometimes there have been some anthropologists who laughed at some of the traditional people who lived in islands in the Pacific, because they called them cargo cults, because they didn't understand that there was this whole global trade thing, and a cargo ship would come in and deliver a cargo, or a plane would fly in and deliver a cargo of goods. And so they started to associate those ships with goods, and the ships were like gods, or the planes were like gods. And if we build an airport, then that means that a plane will land and bring us goodies. Or if we just stand here and wait for the ship to come in without understanding that the ship came in because of some schedule. And ha, 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 they laugh at these people. But that's what this whole culture is a giant cargo cult, that if we build a Walmart, then the materials will suddenly appear on the shelves. And if we build a that windmills or wind energy harvesting facilities and solar energy harvesting facilities, they both just magically appear. They fall from the sky like coconuts. And they don't. Those are manufactured goods that have an entire chain of supply behind them.
Yeah, I think I was going to, my next part that came to me was how I didn't always think, I wasn't always interested in authors like you, and I wasn't always interested in health and well-being so much, even though it was what I was pursuing academically. It didn't really happen for me until, like, I didn't have consciousness raising, so to speak, until I started really getting into my work role and meeting with many, many people and learning about their lives and their histories and how they experience neglects and abuses. And my understanding of the big picture took a while. And my sense is that, I mean, given just the general mental health ignorance of most people that I meet with, is that in the culture, we don't have the luxury of having that expanded understanding. It's just not provided. There's a huge void in self-awareness. There's a void in other awareness, I guess world awareness in many respects. And so, like, we can't very very well, in many cases live sustainably and in healthy ways in our bodies and in our relationships and with the world. And you can't even really see that. Your eyes like need to be opened in a sense. And if you don't have that, you're going to just by default go with what is in front of you, what the system is serving up, what you've been told is normal. And even just even staying sick and fighting all the time in relationships is, can be viewed as normal. Coming down with cancer, it's just something that happens to people. It's just sort of normal. Getting sick mentally is just something that happens. And it doesn't go much further than that. Until you take a serious interest in matters of health one way or the other. Like I think yours sounds like you're interested in the health of the planet. And from my angle, I'm primarily interested in the health of the brain, I guess, and how we live with emotions. But I mean, it seems to boil down to the same stuff, is that, you know, we find ourselves in an abusive relationship with society in general, and the majority of people don't see it.
And it's, yes, I agree. And it's very difficult for a number of reasons. One is that I was talking to this woman 10, 12, 13 years ago who very much loves this undammed river up in Washington State. And she's a fisheries biologist. And she said and rivers flood. She said we misdefine rivers all the time, that we think about them as just sitting in place, but without dams, they writhe across the landscape like a snake. They dance. And so every year there'll be a flood, and the river used to go over here, and now the river goes over here. And she said every time the river floods, it breaks her heart because of all the dead fish and all the dead frogs and all the dead deer, all the dead trees. She got fish stranded over here. You got deer swept away over here, and it breaks her heart for all of those. And at the same time, it makes her really happy because that's what a river does, and it's creating new habitat. And she said this line that just was one of the best lines anybody's ever said to me, which is when a river changes course like that, it's short-term habitat loss and long-term habitat gain. And it suddenly occurred to me that the reason that we stay in crappy relationships quite often is because we're afraid of the short-term loss for the long-term gain. And the reason we stay in jobs we hate is because we're afraid of the short-term loss for the long-term gain. The reason we haven't brought down this culture is because we're afraid of the short-term loss, long-term, for in exchange for the long-term gain.
And could we say including death, short-term loss, including...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, which is true in an abusive relationship too. A woman who leaves a batterer is seven times more likely to die in that period. I'm not dismissing those concerns of short-term habitat loss blithely. I'm just saying that's. I mean, let's take it to an extreme example. You're walking down the street and somebody sticks a gun to your head, and they try to put you in a car. And as everybody knows, you know, when they put you in a car, that's a very bad sign. So they try to put you in a car. You have a choice. I got the short-term habitat loss of trying to run for it right now versus long-term habitat gain of being alive. But they're holding a gun on you, which means the chances are pretty good if you try to run, you're dead. I mean, I'm not being blithe about this at all. And I have Crohn's disease, and every 8 weeks I get a high-tech infusion, you know, an infusion of high-tech medicine. It's been keeping me alive the last 12 years. So I'm very aware that I'm one of the potential, very probable losses as civilization comes down. And that's – the world's more important than I am. But there's another point here too. Wait, I want to finish my old point. Short-term habits, long-term gain – oh, another part of that, and this is one of the reasons I don't think that this culture is going to have a voluntary transformation, is because I was in therapy for 12 years, and helped a lot, but that's 12 years. That's a long time of hard work. And most people don't want to do that. Most people don't want to go through it. And one time it's pretty funny. I asked my therapist, if he had ever, this is like 7 or 8 years in. I asked him, so did you ever have I done anything that's made you uncomfortable or something? I don't know. I don't know how it came up. And he said, well, I got to tell you that when you first started, you know, for the first year, you were doing so much work that I was wondering if you were faking it and basically being the good child and trying to be the good client. And you were making so many changes. And I said, well, of course I'm going to work. That's why I'm here in therapy, and that's why I'm paying you every week. And he said, you know, honestly, most people who come to therapy are doing it either because they have 6 weeks free through work, or because their partner said, either you get in therapy or I'm leaving you. And so it's pro forma, even for the people who show up a lot of times.
Yeah, that's true.
And that blew me away. It's like, why would I go in if I didn't want to do the work? And the point is, so even among the select group of people who go to therapy, a lot of them aren't really trying to change. But the reason I was going to therapy is because I said, look, I was really unhappy. That's why I came here, because I wasn't happy with who I was, and I wanted to figure out how to be better. So why wouldn't I work? That's the point.
So it seems.
Exactly. And so that's one of the things is that, you know, there's this great line by Joseph Campbell about how people of every time until now have understood that to have anything approaching a spiritual life, the first requirement is leisure. And I'm perfectly aware that I wouldn't have not have had the leisure. I mean, if I would have had 3 children and trying to support those 3 children, I would not have had the leisure to go to therapy and then spend the afternoon taking a walk and ruminating and then going to bed and then waking up in the middle of the night with a dream about it that I write down, because I don't have to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning. And it's the same with my writing. I couldn't write. There's this line by John Steinbeck, who was writing a letter to his friend asking if it's possible for a person to go all out on a novel at the same time that they still have a family. And there are writers who do that. Mario Puzo, you know, wrote The Godfather, he had 7 kids running around the house, and he's writing in the living room. Some people can do that. But for me, writing takes a prodigious amount of time where I've been stuck on the last 5 pages for several weeks. And a lot of times the resolution to the specific problems I'll have will come because I take a long walk and the trees give me the answer. And my point is that all of these things take time, which people don't have. And if they're not going to make the changes that make it so that they are capable of having a reasonably healthy, intimate relationship, how many of them are going to take the time to really deconstruct everything about this culture until they can understand that trees are living sentient beings with lives as valuable to them as yours is to you and mine is to me. And the same is true for insects, and the same is true for everybody, and that the entire world is alive. And that's nice, Derek, but I got to pay $1,250 rent next month. It's like, you know, the understanding that trees are living sentient beings, and 25 cents will no longer even buy me a drop of coffee.
I think I was similarly lucky in a way with my developing awareness and with growing in mental health, matters of mental health, and getting relatively healthy. I was lucky enough to be working in a clinic where someone was willing to kind of coach me and guide me and instruct me like not only in matters of the clinic, but in regards to my own health issues. And then I was also lucky to meet with all these people and kind of learn from their lives. And so I was like immersed in this really rich, and I still am, in this really rich mental health educational place. And it's raised my awareness basically, and it's opened me up to learning more about healthy relationships and how that not only applies to people but to the earth itself. And I'm convinced at this point that hardly anybody knows what it means to be in a healthy relationship, healthy relationships plural, with themselves, with partners, with family, with the earth, the awareness and the capability, the concepts, the skills are not installed. They are not installed. And unless you purposefully, and I guess get lucky enough to have the circumstances to get there, I think is kind of what you were saying too, like with, and I appreciate your writing about your father in your book. And it sounds like that was a huge motivational force for you for really going deep into this work about, I mean, human life and civilization and being in abusive relationships. And I like how you also wrote, like, not like it was a good thing that it happened to me, but it turned into a way to go into this work in a deep, meaningful way. Am I wording that right?
It wasn't good. And the thing is, a lot of people who go through trauma, some of the ones who seem to survive the best are the ones who, this language is from Judith Herman, are able to find a survivor mission where you come out the other side. You know, that's the fundamental hero journey that Joseph Campbell talks about in The Hero with a Thousand Faces, where a lot of mythology, a lot of fairy tales are the same. And what they are is that the person leaves the community, goes on some adventure, and fights a demon, and then returns with a gift for the community. And he says that's the fundamental story of a journey to health. And another way to put all this, and this is also from Campbell, that Campbell talked about how for those in whom a local mythology still works, there exists a sense of accord with the universe and a sense of meaning and a sense of connection with the community. So, for example, if the rites of Catholicism work for you, then, you know, if gaining communion does make you feel a connection to the divine and to your community, then, and it brings a sense of meaning into your life, well, that's fine. You have a well-worn path. But if that doesn't work for you, if the local mythology doesn't work for you, then you will go on a quest for meaning, which, because we all need meaning in our lives. And you can have the sort of meaning that's provided by capitalism, where wealth, that provides a sense of purpose and a sense of meaning for some people, I think is a very twisted one that also leads to lots of other, well, sociopathy across the entire culture, and leads to lots of other problems. But the point is that you go on this journey, and then you slay the dragon, which would be you come to terms with the trauma, you come to terms with you find your connection, your place in the universe, and then you come back with gifts for your community. And that works for, you know, Judith Herman says that you can't bury trauma. And you can't basically outlive it. What you can hope to do is live with it and to transcend it. And this is a time, I don't usually like the word transcend because it's so often so anti-body, but this is not it. But in this case, it's transcend becomes, I am no longer this trauma, but the trauma has informed my gifts to the community. And, you know, it's like going to get a vision of hell and then coming back, and you can say, so here's what I observed when I was in hell. And here might be a pathway out of hell, and here may be a path to avoid taking to get into hell. I mean, that's why ex-addict stories are so important for young addicts, because that's what was my path. I was just communicating with an ex-addict a week and a half ago about he had spent, God, decades in prison, and the last stretch is like, you know, I just can't do this anymore. And he's now been clean and sober. He's out of prison, been out of prison for a year or something, 6 months, and he's been clean and sober for 5 years. So, you know, and what he's doing, one of the things he's doing is he's writing a book to help young addicts to try to make it so they don't have to spend that 20 years in prison.
So that's his meaning, and that's a less toxic form of finding meaning. And I like that you brought up the human need for finding meaning. Reminds me of Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, and surely you've read that one. Him in the concentration camps there, and I think people do get hooked on certain forms of finding meaning, and seems like the majority of people are stuck on the one that is destroying the world, unfortunately. And they're not willing to, or they can't, look past that because their experiences thus far have not permitted that capacity.
And they're being rewarded for not looking at it. They're being rewarded because we in the United States, for the most part, are receiving the magnificent bribe of access to computers, access to hot showers, the whole deal. And it's so interesting, you know. You mentioned David Suzuki and the talking of human extinction. There was an op-ed the other day in the New York Times about would human extinction be a bad thing? And the thing I found most interesting about that is that there are more and more people talking in the mainstream for the past 6 or 7 years about human extinction. But there's nobody besides me, really, maybe a couple other people, who are talking explicitly about bringing down civilization. And my point here is simply that it is easier for mainstream people to conceptualize the end of human existence entirely than it is for them to conceptualize stopping this way of being. That's extraordinary. Do you see what I'm getting at? This is completely horrifying that they can actually conceptualize. I mean, they would literally rather that this species, you know, screw the rest of the earth because they don't care anyway, but they would literally rather this species die off than talk about getting rid of computers, getting rid of industrial electricity. One of them, It is thinkable for them to speak of the end of the human species. It is unthinkable for them to think about the end of computer culture, car culture, capitalism. That's how deep our loyalty is to the system, that we will prefer the system over life on Earth, over human life on Earth. And this, of course, is something that we see in abusive dynamics too, that absolutely central to the maintenance of an abusive system must be everyone's absolute loyalty to the abusive system. And this makes sense for the kids, because if your life depends on dad's mood, then you learn to read dad's mood. And in fact, your life does not depend upon your own mood. So you don't actually have to attend to your own mood, because your own mood isn't dangerous. Mom's mood's not dangerous. Brother's mood's not dangerous. Sister's mood's not dangerous. Dog's mood's not dangerous. We don't care about any of their moods. We care about his mood, and we care about taking care of him, because our life depends on it. That is sort of tangibly one of the ways that the fancy word identification with the oppressor takes place.
Have you ever seen that TV show Walking Dead?
No, I haven't. I do like zombies, but I've never seen the show.
They have a character in there named Negan, and he runs sort of a sub community out of the living humans that haven't turned into zombies yet. And he runs it in a very oppressive, like a way that in a set of circumstances we're living in, but just much more obvious. So like if someone went against his rules, then he would torture them in front of everybody, sort of thing. And then, people became so hopelessly dependent on him and so loyal that they would actually, he would say, "What's your name?" And then they would say, "My name is like your name. My name's Negan." So they actually became so identified right. with him. They called themselves by the same name.
That's
and they would fight to the death to support his version of society.
That's pretty clear.
Yeah. And he would test their loyalty by asking them their name. What's your name? Right. And yes. And I think where people get to the extinction part, quite honestly, is they see the maybe the hopelessness in any resistance. Their sense is that it's gone on too long, it's gone too far. Resistance is futile and it's a waste of time. And you know, the best we can do is kind of give in to the inevitable end.
Okay, so you are in a room in a house. You yourself or you the listener, doesn't matter. Whoever's hearing this. You are tied up. And someone is slowly torturing you to death. And there are people in another room, and they can hear you being tortured. What do you want those people to do? Do you want them to say, "Oh, sorry, resistance is futile"? No, what you'd want them to do is to do whatever's necessary to stop the horrors. And they could say, "Well, it's not that way, because instead of it being one person there torturing you, there's an entire army. And they'll shoot us when we go in." Well, they're going to shoot you anyway. And, you know, the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. Well, you could argue, that's fine, Derek, but the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising didn't win World War II. That was really the U.S. Air Force and primarily the Russian military. And there's no Russian army coming to save us. This culture is too strong. And I say, no, that's not true. There is something that's stronger, which is the natural world. And align yourself with that. So, you know, in my book Dreams, I asked a really stupid question. I kept asking, you know, the Dreams is about, is the world sentient? Is where do dreams come from? Is there anything besides sort of a mechanistic philosophy, a mechanistic existence? And one of the questions I asked is, if the world is sentient, then why isn't it fighting back? And then about a week after the book went to press, I think I realized this is the stupidest question ever, because the world is fighting back all the time. You know, there was a recent hurricane that stopped like 80% of oil production or 50% of oil production in the region. I don't see resistance movements doing that. I was walking through I was flying through out of St. Louis one day, 10, 12 years ago, coming home from a tour, and an entire wing of the airport was closed because a tornado had come through. And the world's trying to, what do you think plants are? What do you think rot is in a house? That's nature saying, "Hey, I want to turn this back into forests. I want to turn this back into grasslands." And the world's resisting all the time. And so far as those who say it's too late, so I always say the same thing that my environmental mentor, John Osborne, he and I became friends in the late 80s, and he's a wonderful, wonderful activist, wonderful friend. And whenever I ask him why he's doing the work he is, he always says, the crystal ball is always cloudy. And as things become increasingly chaotic, I want to make sure that some doors remain open. And what he means by that is if bull trout are still around in 10 years, they may still be around in 100. But if they're gone in 10, they're gone forever. And if some patch of forest is standing now, it may be standing in 100 years. But if it's gone, it's gone. And so what we need to do is to – I have so much respect for all those environmentalists who are protecting this or that scrap of ground or this or that large area of ground or who are protecting this or that being, this or that species of plant or animal or fungi. I have so much respect for all that. And then in addition, there's an image that keeps coming to me of somebody has been stabbed a bunch of times. They get wheeled into the emergency room, and then they're wheeled into to a place where the doctors and nurses can work on them. And everybody, the person is just bleeding profusely from stab wounds everywhere. And everybody's putting on bandages, and they're doing everything they can to help this person, pumping in blood. And they're doing everything they can except for the most important thing of all, which is the madman is still there stabbing the body, stabbing the person. And so in addition to us covering all the band, putting all the bandages on, which is incredibly important, we also need to stop the primary murder of the planet. And we're talking about life on the planet here. We are not merely talking about this or that particular species, as important as that is. And so we have nothing to lose. And when you have nothing to lose, you can become very, very dangerous. There's a wonderful line by the Zen poet Bunan, which is, die while you're alive and be absolutely dead. Then do whatever you want. It's all good. And, you know, think about this in terms of interpersonal relationships. You can have a relationship that's just falling apart and it's bad and it's got good parts, but it's got all this terrible stuff. And then at some point, I've had this happen where there's just this sudden clarity. It's like, I give up. I'm not going to try to fix this relationship. And then at that point, if you break up, it's great. If you stay together, it's great. This is the fundamental message. This is one of the things that kills me. I don't think that humans in general are very smart, because we can take all these great ideas and then turn them into things that are just really stupid. And it cracks me up that there's this great line by Joseph Campbell about all the people who take the Bible literally, that's like eating the cereal box instead of the cereal. Because that's the story of Jesus dying and being reborn. And that's this whole story of the second coming. It's not that there's going to be somebody show up in 2026. And it's not that Jesus was a real person who died on a cross and then rose up to heaven 3 days later. And it was all – that's not what the story is about. The story is about before you can have a plant, you bury the seed. And then it comes back up. And before – you can – that's the whole point of this 12-step program is you have to recognize you're powerless. You have to go, I'm dead. This has happened so many times when I'm writing. I'll be trying to write something. It's just crap, 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 crap. I write crap and I write more crap. And then I just say to the muse, I give up. I can't do it. And the muse is like, okay, I'll work with you now. And it's the same on, I've known so many addicts. It's like they keep trying to work and then they just have to die. That's the whole point of have you been born again. It doesn't have anything to do with religion. One way you can look at it is decolonization. So many indigenous people have said to me that the most important thing we can do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And what that involves is the colonized you dies, and then the new you comes out. It's like the central metaphor of life.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly of emotional health.
I was going to ask you one part about where I got up to in the book. We've gone over an hour there. Are you okay with continuing a little longer? Or?
Let's do one more question.
Okay. Just the part about bringing, I think you were sort of alluding to it too, of the bringing down civilization part. And how many or so many of the people in the human population are lost to the abusive relationship of being in society. It sounds like, and you often say in your book, what are you going to do? Right? You ask that question, it comes up now and again. And it almost sounds like you're suggesting that it has to be extreme measures. And it reminds me of something one of my colleagues says. She used to work in, on a farm, and she understands how herds of cattle, how they run the farm. And she would say, if you have an unwell animal, you have to cull that animal so that the herd can survive. And you know, so it sounds like if you're really looking at this from a biological, ecological, I guess, environmental perspective, it sounds like you're suggesting like it has to be extreme measures or it's not going to work. Like the ones that are hopelessly dependent on being in the abusive relationship, they have to, I mean, and I get how diabolical that can sound. Is it like you're saying they got to go? Is that what you're saying?
Well, okay. There are too many humans on the planet. And by saying that, I'm not saying that there are too many brown people. There's too many people total, especially those who use high technology. So overconsumption is worse than overpopulation, but there's doesn't matter. There's more humans than the planet can support. And just the other day, an interviewer asked me, so how would you reduce population? I could reduce population very easily through entirely non-draconian changes. And that's right now more than half of the humans who are born are not actually wanted. About half, a little bit under half, I think, are children are actively intentional children. And so the answer to that is to give women absolute reproductive freedom across the world. That would solve overpopulation. Well, not just like that. It would take 20, 30, 40 years as it declines down, but and many studies have shown that the single most effective thing you can do to reduce the number of children that a woman has is to teach little girls to read. So there's my solution to overpopulation. Teach little girls to read, give women absolute reproductive freedom. The problem is that you run into patriarchal religions, where men want control over women's bodies. And the other problem is you run into capitalism / civilization / agriculture, really, which is a Ponzi scheme and always requires new suckers. It always requires new consumers. And so it's pretty horrifying and funny and startling and terrible to compare or contrast the rhetoric around overpopulation about, say, Africa versus Russia or Japan. And in Africa, people will go, oh my gosh, there's too many babies. We have to force feed them contraceptives. And in Russia and Japan, they'll say, oh gosh, you're not having enough babies because the birth rate is not matching the death rate. And so the population's going down. So you need to have – they will actually make work holidays, sex holidays, for people to go home and have sex and hopefully have babies. And the point is that lets you know capitalism's perspective on overpopulation, which is you need more consumers. Problem is the people in Africa aren't consuming enough. So – but you need more consumers in Russia. The whole thing is a Ponzi scheme. And so my point is, every cell in my body wants for there to be a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living. But we all know it's not going to happen. So what does that mean for our strategy and for our tactics? And the answer is we don't know. And the reason we don't know is because we don't talk about it. And the reason we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that windmills are going to work. And windmills don't help desert tortoises. They don't help the natural world. And so I'm reminded often of something that my mother often said to me when I was a child, which is she would tell me to clean my room, and I wouldn't do it. And then she would tell me to clean the room. I wouldn't be defiant. I just wouldn't get around to it. And then she would keep telling me to clean the room. I keep would just not getting around to it until finally she would say, okay, your room will be cleaned by dinner. If you don't clean it by dinner, I am cleaning your room. And if I clean your room, you're not going to like it because I'm throwing everything away. And that's how I think about what's going on in the world is we can – I wish we would use our self-declared intelligence to fix things, to actually make things go the right direction.
Change the rules of the game, right?
Change the rules of the game. And if we don't clean up our mess, nature will clean it up for us. And we're not going to like it because it's going to throw everything away.
I like that analogy.
All of my work comes down to one thing, which is this culture cannot last. And when this culture comes down, I would prefer that there is more life left on the planet than less. That's it. How do we get there? Those are the questions.
And like it reminds me of that one part in the book that I read there, and I hope you don't mind me. It's probably one of the more personal parts. You said if you had known that you couldn't get out of the abusive relationship with your father when you were a kid, I think you said that you would have killed him.
With the knowledge I have now, and with the knowledge I have now that he would not change, and with the knowledge I have now that you know the police weren't going to rescue us, that no magic force was going to come. Yeah, I'm doing a heartbeat.
So that type of, thinking, I'm challenging you so early in the relationship of getting to know you, but it's in my nature to ask these questions. For resistance, is that what you're saying about how people need to mobilize and the kind of aggression that to save the save habitat?
I'm saying that if we had numbers that we could do everything peacefully. I'm talking about levers. I'm saying that if you could have 1 million people blockade oil terminals, we could shut down the oil economy. We don't have 1 million people. And there are other ways to shut down oil economies. The movement for the emancipation of Niger Delta through a few kidnappings and sets of explosions was able to shut down, I believe, 80% of Nigeria's oil output for a while. And they ultimately weren't doing it because they wanted to stop all oil exploration. They simply wanted for their people to not be as exploited. They wanted some of that, which is not unreasonable at all, given that their livelihoods were destroyed. What I'm saying is that there is only one planet that we know of in the universe that has life, and this culture is destroying it. And I don't And once you, the most important thing to do is to transfer your loyalty away from the economic and social system and to life on the planet. And once you do that, then you need to defend life on the planet, and you need to defend local land base. And I have sometimes been pegged as the violence guy, and I think that that's really unfair, because I'm really the everything guy. And I've had people come up and say, oh, so should we go assassinate the CEO? And it's like, you filed any timber sale appeals yet? And it's like, go through the various processes. It's like my friend Thomas Lindsay, one of the things he does is he helps communities to pass self-determination laws saying that there will not be fracking allowed within their city limits, or there will be no hog farms allowed in their county, and corporate hog farms. And he does this. It's very interesting. So he empowers people all over the country to use the rules of democracy in order to try to get some community autonomy. And I asked him one time, so you know that the Commerce Clause of the Constitution reserves rights to interstate commerce, regulating that to the federal government, which means you can't go into a community and have the community pass a law saying that Walmart can't come in. If you do that, the states and feds are going to come in and crack down on you. And he said, well, that's the point, is that people believe we live in a democracy. I give them the tools of democracy, help them employ those tools of democracy, and then they get stepped on by the feds. And can you think of a faster way to build a revolutionary cadre than to take people who believe we live in a democracy, give them those tools, and watch what happens? So the point is, I think we need to, you know, I'm not suggesting that people go and assassinate somebody, because I do believe that in World War II, the plot to assassinate Hitler was a very, very good idea, because without Hitler, the German resistance recognized that Hitler was still immensely popular, even when they were losing the war. And they recognized that there was no way they could stop the war without getting rid of him. Power is not concentrated the same way. So what I'm suggesting is that people figure out how to most effectively resist. And the big distinction is always not between those who believe that militant resistance may be necessary and those who don't. The big distinction is between those who get off their butt and do something and those who don't. And what I'm really wanting people to do is to figure out where their gifts are and figure out what they love. And whatever they love, it's under assault. And so, you know, find what you love and then defend your beloved. If it doesn't matter whether that means, you know, going wading in a pond and collecting some tadpole eggs or frog eggs and then releasing the tadpoles. It doesn't matter if it's that or if it's filing a timber sale appeal or if it's taking out logging equipment. It doesn't matter. It's the important thing is get off your butt and do something.
Like find a way to adjust the relationship as it is, even if it's just millions of little things, I guess, right? Is kind of what you're saying, right?
Well, yeah, because I can't do everything and you can't do everything. And there are so many problems. It's like I have a friend, Charlotte Watson, who used to run the battered women's program for the state of New York. And now she acts as an advocate for battered women in the court system. And I would never suggest that she quit what she's doing and go work on salmon issues, or that she quit what she's doing and learn how to build explosives, you know, or anything else. I'm not suggesting that at all, because she's tackling a very real problem. And that's the great thing about everything being so messed up is no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. I mean, we're crying out loud. You know, most of the U.S. military in World War II never fired a shot in combat. I mean, even a military has almost everybody's in support work. And so we desperately need people to protect prairie dogs. And we desperately need people to work on mental health issues. And we desperately need people to figure out why so many indigenous women are getting murdered. And we need people to figure out – it's like there's all these issues. And just choose one. And it doesn't matter, again, whether it's mental health or whether it's – because they're all interconnected. And it's just – it would be ridiculous. Yes, the world's getting killed. And if the world is killed, then at that point, women who are battered are not going to matter because they'll all be dead. So, yes, there's that sense. But that doesn't alter the fact that that's work that needs to be done. And that's also work that needs to be done because, frankly, how you make the next generation of abusers is by abusing them. So, you know, Charlotte is also helping to create, as well as helping the women right now, she's helping to create a better future right there by making it so those children are not going to be abused.
Yeah, one of my favorite parts of doing my work is when I get to meet with a new mother, maybe in the age of like 20, 21, and they're interested in mental health and how to be a healthy mother. That is one of my favorite things because, and I see their genuine interest because then I know that they're going to probably be raising a child who has some understanding of emotions and how to live in a human body and what healthy relationships look like. Just to have a stable, healthy mother to attach to and grow up with. And that's going to make some difference over time.
That'll make a huge difference.
Yeah, I say it's the best gift you can give your child. It's just to be a healthy mother.
Yep.
So, yeah, thank you so much, Derek, for meeting with me and going over these things and asking some of my point-blank questions.
Well, yeah, thanks for the interview.
Your work and your book, and I really do appreciate the videos that you do at Deep Green Videos on YouTube and
everything
that you're doing. So maybe we can meet in the future sometime if opportunity permits, and if not, then that's okay too. And I'll be posting this video soon on YouTube and with a neutral title for sure.
Okay. So when you do, let me know, and I will then I'll post it around.
Okay, cool.
Well, thanks so much.
Thanks, and have a great day, and welcome to 2019. Have a happy new year.
Yeah, you too.
Okay, see you later. Okay.
Bye.